and the idea was to see the Salzburg Festival not as a competitor, but as a complement. They also said, well, this is also possible for a day trip. For example, people can go to the festival, for example, then go on a day trip and stop there. That was actually the main motive, a tourist attraction.
That's Sibylle Campbell, who curated the exhibition on the construction of the road together with Andreas Sangl. And with that, welcome to the Glockner Gipfel. My name is Max Kugel, and today Sibylle Campbell and Andreas Sangl are guiding me through the exhibition in the road maintenance depot at the Fuschelacke. In the middle of the most beautiful adventure road in Europe, and I can't wait to see what awaits me. So have fun with Austria's highest view. Welcome to the Glockner Gipfel. I'm back on the Großglockner High Alpine Road to visit an exhibition. And today I'm meeting with Sibylle Campbell and Andreas Sangl, the two curators of the exhibition on the construction of the road. And the exhibition can be found in the so-called Wegemarker House or Street Warden's House. And I'm in front of it now and have the pleasure of welcoming the two curators. What's the story behind this house we're standing in front of now? Why is it called Wegemarker House and here it says Straßenwärter House?
In this house, the roadmakers or roadkeepers lived in it. It was built long after the opening of the Großglockner High Alpine Road. There was also a construction camp on the site at the time the Großglockner High Alpine Road was built. And of course, the camps were then removed and this little house was built there. It is now a listed building.
Very good. And now that it's pretty much a foggy and cold day, I'd say let's go inside. It's definitely more comfortable, I'd say. So now we're in here. We already know Ms. Campbell from episode 2 and the Bergdi exhibition. Andreas Sangl is also taking part in this exhibition and in today's podcast. I would ask you to perhaps introduce yourself briefly.
Of course I will do so. Andreas Sangl, as I said, my name, I'm an exhibition planner. I'm the one who is involved from the idea onwards to say what the rooms look like, how the storylines work, what stories we tell, how we tell them, what the levels of mediation look like. And I like working with Sibylle. I also have to mention Markus Meyerhofer on this occasion. He's part of the team, and we're in charge of this project here about the construction of the road, for example, from the very beginning right through to the opening.
Very good. And we are now in the first room, and I now have the pleasure of having you show me around a bit and explain a little about what we can see here and what you can experience as a visitor. In the first room, we now see a display board and there is the media event. And on the screen, we can also follow the historical pictures of the opening ceremony. But I don't think it was just one opening. There were several.
There were four openings in total. The whole road was divided into individual sections, the so-called northern edge to southern edge, and then the middle section into the crown section. And different sections were opened depending on this. And each section was documented with films and a relatively large amount of photographic material, which of course benefits us today, but was not really a matter of course at the time.
This means, however, that the staging of the media event was quite deliberate and planned.
In any case, Franz Wallach, who planned the roads and was then a construction manager, was simply a very, very skillful media man, so he knew very well how to stage himself and also his construction also in advance with the many presentations that he gave. He simply did a good job of advertising and marketing to get the project off the ground. And of course, he also deserved to celebrate it accordingly.
A bit like the A, B and C celebrities do these days who call the paparazzi themselves and say, tomorrow I'll be there, come with the camera.
Yes, exactly like that.
And the final opening of the Großglockner High Alpine Road, as we know it today, was in August 1935.
Exactly, the 3rd of August 1935. That was the really big opening, and Wallach was always lucky with the openings. The weather was always wonderful. He called it Glockner weather. And that's why we have film of that day, of the opening speeches and all the hostilities.
Exactly. You can also admire it on a screen in the first room. Okay, now we're in the passageway to the first room. And now we're going way back, and here we're told a little bit that the route over the Grossglockner has a very, very long history and goes back a long way.
Exactly. We're not just going back 100 years to the start of construction, but a few thousand years back, because the road here actually goes back to the 2nd millennium BC. Since then, at least that's what we know, the route has been traveled, the route has already been traveled for the transportation of copper, iron and salt. It is part of a Roman trade route. The route that Wallach then took was partly based on this original Roman trade route, or at least on some sections of the route. You can also see a late Celtic Roman pass sanctuary found up here, and some of the things that were found there are on display, primarily as replicas. And yes, it was simply an important route even in the Middle Ages. It was traveled on foot or with pack animals. There was gold mining up here. And the Archbishop of Salzburg, for example, used this path to transport the Galerian slaves from Salzburg to Venice, which he sold down there.
But what we see here in the windows are replicas, aren't they?
Yes, they are replicas. That's what it always says. So if it's a replica, then it's there. If it's not a replica, then if it doesn't say so, then you know it's real.
The Roman shoes are certainly not real, I know that. But we have made an effort to make them look authentic. It really is an attempt to recreate it authentically and the way it was. We can also see the Ötzi shoe there, for example. It's a replica, of course. Yes, and if you go over the Glockner, you wear special mountain boots today, well lined. Back then there were no insoles, just straw.
Yes, and it's definitely not the DJ's shoe?
It's not the DJ's shoe, no. Okay, not bad, chapeau.
Now we continue through the corridor. And now I could decide whether to go straight ahead to the right or up the stairs. Andreas, perhaps you'd like to explain a bit about how the exhibition is structured.
I'll do that. The idea was to move away from the opening and then go to the three people, or groups of people, or go into more detail about them, who in their visionary power were simply central to the project. On the one hand, we have Governor Rerl, who really had the power to assert himself in a visionary force without whom it would not have worked. At the same time, we have Franz Wallach, who we will talk about later, who in his own way, as far as the construction is concerned, I don't know if excessive is the right word, but he was the right man for this project. And then, of course, we really go into detail. We have the people or the workers who realized it. That is the basic structure of the exhibition.
Let's go into the room and there's a big heading. A visionary has a hard time. I would conclude from that. You called Franz Rerl a visionary, so to speak. Why or what was so visionary about the then governor, Franz Rerl?
As far as the vision is concerned, it was a project in a difficult time. God knows we're talking about the 20s or, yes, the 20s. We know, Sibylle will say something later, yes, there were some problems. It was shortly after the war. Inflation was horrendous in reality. And from today's perspective, we can say that it's almost ridiculous. And at a time like this, in this difficult basic constellation, to simply say, I don't want to build these roads over the Glockner, but I'll make sure that the money is put up, I'll make sure that we find the right people. Yes, how else? What is the definition of a visionary? So someone really had the political vision, or ultimately this vision, but that's what I want to do. And I think that was the person who had that certain amount of stubbornness, but also diplomacy, to say I'm going to push it through.
Okay, and Sibylle, what would you say was the vision, or what was the purpose of building the road in these particularly difficult times, as we have just heard?
Yes, you might have to start from the beginning with the vision, because it wasn't entirely his vision. The Federal Ministry of Trade and Transport had already had the idea of building a road there. The roads up to the Glockner had already been used by cars for decades, and these roads belonged to the Alpenverein, and they wanted to practically expand it. And then they organized a meeting, today we would call it a meeting, a kickoff meeting or something, and representatives from the state of Salzburg and the state of Carinthia were there, and they came up with the idea and set up a committee. And then Governor Rerl slowly joined in at some point, and then Wallach got the job, and then in a very short time presented this plan Franz Rehl had already carried out several construction projects before, for example, the Geisbergstrasse up in Salzburg, in the city of Salzburg, which was his work. So he was open for construction projects and no longer as prestige projects for his political career, but really out of the knowledge that Austria, this small country that it was after the First World War, simply has to become independent, has to get on its feet. He was simply a good crisis manager, you have to say. The other thing was that, of course, because South Tyrol was no longer there, a crossing of the Alps was simply needed. And then you have to say that the main motive was a tourism project. So the road was intended from the outset as an excursion road, as an excursion project. The Salzburg Festival was already there. And they wanted it to be the counter project. The Salzburg Festival was not seen as a competitor, but as a complement. They also said, well, this is also possible for a day trip. For example, people can visit the festival in one day and drive up there too. That was actually the main motive, a tourist attraction, which it still is today. Back then, it was also partly a transit route. That's actually its function, which it hardly has anymore.
Yes, we also learned that in first episode of the Glockner Gipfel, so I learned it from Dr. Johannes Hörl, that the motivation was not to build the fastest route from Salzburg to Carinthia, but to build an adventure road that would serve a tourist purpose and showcase the beauty of nature. And then I would say, let's go into the next room. Now we are in the room with the heading, The Pioneer, and it's about Franz Wallach, well known as the builder of the Großglockner High Alpine Road. And it's also a bit about his person, his history, and his art as an engineer.
Yes, exactly. So Franz Wallach was born in Vienna. And even in his youth, in his childhood and youth, he was very artistic. So he painted a lot, he played music, and actually wanted to pursue a career as an artist. But he lost out on that with his father. He didn't want that at all. And then, as was the case back then, he did what his parents wanted and studied civil engineering. He then worked at the Carinthian State Building Authority. Then came the First World War, when he was stationed in Serbia and South Tyrol. He was also in the Carinthian Defensive Campaign. So he really did have the difficult years and experienced the dark times of life at the time. And then in the year 1924 got this order and wasn't just the builder or site manager, but actually planned the road himself. So he went into the field himself and laid out the whole route.
In today's parlance, you could perhaps say that he designed the road.
Yes, he designed the road. You could really say design, because design is also understood to mean that you don't just something that only fulfills a function, but that he added an incredible amount of aesthetics to the functionality. And that was actually a very important premise for him. Not just to make this path, this road, but to really integrate it into nature and create as many viewpoints as possible. So that is certainly a balancing act that had to be achieved. Especially when you look at the terrain, we're not just talking about some herbaceous hill above it, but up to the Großglockner and over it, a road that would create vantage points that would not disturb nature, but which is really harmoniously integrated. So the word harmoniously integrated was very important to him.
Yes. It is often the case with artistically inclined personalities that they have a different eye for beauty and not just for the practical.
Exactly. And he certainly lived out his artistic talents during the construction. We are now benefiting from this because he took an incredible amount of photographs, both of the route and then of the construction work. He even made films, and he also wrote poems, and he also wrote pieces of music, the Hochtorlied, for example, and so on. He did that practically in his job, which he then had, and these creative inclinations that he had the opportunity to pursue them there.
And here we now see a life-size picture of him, also in black and white, and a display case with a tie in red. What's that all about?
Once again, he was known for always wearing the same clothes, but that doesn't mean that he didn't attach any importance to clothing. Quite the opposite. In the photo, he actually looks more like an American movie actor, dressman-like, so it doesn't really get much cooler than that. On the one hand, you can see that he has cigarettes on his hand, and that was a permanent condition, so he really was a chain smoker. And the other thing is that he always wore the so-called sport suit. It was just a knot, it was like a pair of knee breeches, and with it, usually a white shirt and an orange and red tie, and that's what he always wore, whether he was going to the building site or to any negotiations. He also wore this at the opening, so you never really saw him in anything else. And these suits were hanging in the construction offices and everywhere. In other words, he was able to change his clothes everywhere.
Aha, so I come from a bit of an advertising background, so you could say he also staged himself a bit as a brand?
Yes, exactly. That's corporate design, by himself.
Yes, and then by the way, next to this portrait and the tie, I see a telephone. What's that all about, Andreas?
Of course, you tried to incorporate interactions in the room with the telephone comrade Wallach in a flashback. How he talks about the time, his experiences. It's a really exciting interview. The phone is an original one from the time, so pick up the phone and listen.
Okay, yes, then I'll pick up the phone.
Ein von den Landesregierungen in Kärnten, Salzburg, geschaffener Ausschuss, hatte mir im Jahre 1924 den Auftrag erteilt, eine Straße über den Alpen.
Before we move on to the next room, I would like to say that there are screens here too, and there is a movie playing in the background, but we have now turned down the sound so that we can record the interview. Normally there is a sound movie running here. Andreas, would you like to tell us a bit about it?
We thought about it. It's always important in an exhibition that you present things in a low threshold or very fun way. And in this case, we thought how this could have happened, how Franz Wallach first conceived and then built this. Wallach first dreamed up this road and then built it. And we then worked with Simon Wendler to plan an animated film, or we teamed up with Simon Wendler, where you can see how the road rolled through this landscape, so to speak, and what might have happened. It's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek approach, but it should simply give an overview in a very short time of how it really is, what stations there are, what sites there are, but ultimately also convey with a bit of relish how Franz Wallach has imagined in his head. I think it's a very good film. There are also some anecdotes. There's the Kaiser Franz Josef in one scene that gives the Kaiser Franz Josef Höhe its name. We see the marmots who are in a parallel world and jump into the Fuscher Lake that's running on screen right now. So it's a mixture of historically accurate, but as I said, always with a wink.
Right. And now before I leave the room for good, I see another screen here and it says start game, and above it is the so-called variant dispute. So a bit of interaction again.
Perhaps we need to briefly explain the variant dispute. So Franz Wallach and Franz Rehl have the same first name but didn't always have the same opinion. Rehl wanted a different route for the middle section of the road. So they were largely in agreement on the north and south ramps, but the main middle section, Rehl wanted the route to be mainly on the Salzburg side. He was the governor of Salzburg, so that had a bit to do with it. And Franz Wallach wanted a route that was much longer, really a few kilometers longer, 16 kilometers to be precise, but that was simply the better option. And this dispute dragged on for years and also delayed construction. Rehl wanted the route that was more prone to avalanches. The snowmelt was later there and it was very important for the roads that they could be open for as long as possible. And if the snow lasts longer in the spring, then you can't open the road there. The construction costs would have been higher and it would have been less attractive because it would have practically gone under the Fandelscharte. A very long tunnel would have had to be built. And in the end, the two simply couldn't come to an agreement. And then they brought in a practically uninvolved expert from Switzerland, an older gentleman. There are quite nice photos of him riding around on a donkey up there and looking at the route. And he said quite a lot during the 2 days of the inspection. But in the end, it was absolutely clear that he was right about Franz Wallach, and Rehl then bowed. And then there was the opening, and Franz Rehl was standing on top of the Edelweiss-Spitze. There's the anecdote, he was so enthusiastic about the finished road that he then said to Franz Wallach that he must have been right and allegedly offered him his friendship at this point.
A Above the game, I can now see a photo of a car with two men inside. I assume that's Franz Wallach and Franz Rerl, and they're driving on a road here. If I'd say that it looks adventurous, it would be a great understatement of what you see in this picture. What's it all about?
Yes, it's daring and adventurous. Absolutely. So this ride took place the day before the third opening. Franz Rerl simply imagined that he wanted to be the first person to drive his car over it, over the track. And he told Franz Wallach that he wanted to do it. And Wallach then really walked the route that night and looked to see where else he could do some optimizing. Even in one of the tunnels that wasn't finished yet, some of the poles had to be removed so that it would work out. And then the two of them, with just two technicians in the back, drove this route, and Wallach wrote a book a few years later about the construction of the Großglockner Hochalpenstraße. And he also wrote very well. And then also writes that it was anything but a comfortable ride. He didn't put it quite so delicately. And yes, they made it. They drove over it, were cheered along the way, partly by the workers, partly by the people in Heiligenblut, or just the inhabitants there.
It says above it that parts of the bodywork of the car had to be removed so that the car could cross the unfinished narrow road?
Exactly. Parts were simply removed, and solved this quite cleverly, also from a marketing point of view, by placing two banner that says First Tower and Crossing. And there is, of course, there really is a movie about it and many, many media effective photographs. So that was very much intentional. It wasn't just Rerl's thought, I want to drive over it now that I'm the first, but of course it was also marketing. He always had to somehow justify what all this money was being spent on.
So it was definitely staged?
Yes, definitely.
And now there's a small staircase up to the second floor, and here is written in large letters with bare numbers on the way up and a display board where quite impressive numbers are documented. The first one says 460,000 cubic meters of earth were moved and 410,000 cubic meters of rock were blasted. So massive figures indeed.
Yes, massive numbers, especially if you look at it in the context of the time of the 1930s. If you take the figures, if you take huge, large construction projects today, nowadays, for example, when a huge airport is being built, the figures are perhaps not so surprising. But at that time, it was the largest construction project, biggest construction project that had probably ever taken place up to that point. And there are many other things on top of that. The project is not on a greenfield site, but on the mountain at insane altitude. And there are many things that simply make it more difficult, and that is also the issue at the top.
Because you just said airport, there have been a few projects in recent years. Berlin Airport, for example, have not quite been completed on time or on budget as planned. What was it like with the Großglockner Hochalpenstraße? Was it completed on time and finished on time and on budget?
I think Berliners could have had a look at it. Yes, yes, it was finished on schedule.
So let's go up the stairs then. Okay, now we've arrived on the second floor, and the first headline I see here is Curtain Up for the Glockner Baraba, and it's also beautifully realized here with a curtain on the left and right, a concrete curtain. Andreas, why?
In this case, we wanted to mention the ones you sometimes forget, Wallach doesn't, by the way, really roll in front of the curtain. It's a project that has to be pushed through politically, a project that has to be well planned. We have talked about this, but a project like this has to be implemented. To paraphrase Bert Precht, you could say, how did the Great Wall of China get built? And we really wanted to give these people the space they deserve, to show their backgrounds, where they came from. What were their conditions like? What was their, albeit sparse, free time like? And what obstacles and burdens did they have to deal with? And that's just right on the concrete curtain, which you've already mentioned.
Who or what are the Glockner Baraba?
The Glockner Baraba are the workers. That sounds a bit crude, but it's a name they've given themselves. Perhaps we should start at the beginning. There were times of high unemployment in the 1930s, and that's why the requirement for the construction of the road, that a large proportion, 80% of the workers, were assigned by the employment office. Unemployment was, of course, also very high in the city. You can also read here, hairdressers and waiters came from Vienna with completely inadequate clothing and no proper shoes. And they just tried to find work here.
But they weren't trained as construction workers?
Not at all. So not only untrained, but also physically unable to stand it. And they weren't used to the mountain. They weren't used to the mountain air. And that happened relatively quickly. Some of them made it, but the majority of the workers were from Salzburg, Carinthia, and East Tyrol. So that was core group that formed, and they were pretty much welded together. And they really did call themselves the Glockner Baraba, and that really was a kind of title and not a swear word. So that's how you have to look at it.
And here in a display case, I can also see a large frying pan and a meat grinder, and you can also learn a bit about how they lived here during their work. They didn't go home to their houses or apartments, but they had to stay up here.
Yes, life away from the actual construction work is definitely a very exciting chapter. There were a total of 20 construction camps, which were built up bit by bit. They were wooden barracks that were prefabricated houses, practically prefabricated houses, which were really dismantled and then practically rebuilt in the next place, and then rebuilt the construction camp in the next place. Of course, there were some at the same time. And the construction camps were of different sizes and differently equipped, but in the best case there really were, so living barracks were a matter of course. There was a canteen. There was a workers' kitchen, which meant that you could cook for yourself if you couldn't afford the food in the canteen. There were washrooms, even stores, so you could shop also. The supplies were brought up from the valley and sold here. There were, of course, magazines, offices, workshops, a so-called Maradenzimmer for the sick, and a so-called culture barrack. It was mainly set up by the Glockner pastor. His name was Mr. Stiglitz, the pastor Stiglitz, who was hired for the spiritual well-being and for the work. He was simply there to talk. He didn't just conduct the church services upstairs. He also visited the sick and gave lectures, so he must have been quite a mysterious and nice person. And he took care of these cultural barracks where there were books, where there were games, where there was also a radio, and those were very lonely times around there. And one must understand there were also very unstable times politically, and the workers were also politically on one side and the other groups on the other side, so there were probably also disputes, and there have also been scuffles and things like that. And even there he tried to calm things down and help.
And back then, it was still a long way to a 5-day or even 4-day working week like we have nowadays, but they still didn't work around the clock, and the workers still had a bit of free time, and that had to be organized, so to speak.
It also had to be organized. Payday was every 2 weeks, and some took the money, unfortunately, and practically drank it away in the canteen on the weekend off, or they gambled it away in the canteen. But many also really went down for the weekend and then posted the money at the post office to send it home. And some also went on hikes at the weekends or in their free time to look at the street from above, for example, to look at the construction sites from above, to get a different perspective of their work. And I also found that very amusing. Some people just slept the whole weekend.
You can understand that after all the hard work, which we'll talk about in a moment, we have now arrived in the last room and there are the largest display cases with the largest exhibit so far. I would now estimate that these are the tools from the time when people worked with them.
Exactly so it is. We have the room idea. We have got to know the protagonists. Now comes the street in the center of attention. We've often talked about the conditions under which people worked there. We really do see simple hammers, pointed hooks, pneumatic drills, explosives and even saws, simply original objects. And on the other hand, before we perhaps go into detail, at the center of the whole story, we called it the Entbergte Straße. We thought that the Großglockner Hochalpenstraße is actually only known in the context of the landscape, and we also wanted to somehow almost put this artwork of the street building, which this street definitely is, at the center of the room, and therefore really recreated the street. very true to detail, from acrylic sticks in this case, where you can see what this street looks like without the mountains, and I personally say, it really is a work of art. Incidentally, you can also interact with the artwork. There are drawers that you can open.
Yes, I'm curious as ever. I'll look inside again.
But now you can see the stables light up. And a little idea of what it's all about. In this case, you've hit the Hochmes. Compare the historical photo. What does it look like today? Has even changed a bit. A barrel construction. And on the other hand, a location in the context of the street. By the way, we rebuilt it from Fusch to Heiligenblut.
Because you and I have already seen each other in episode 2 of the Glockner Gipfel in the Berg die Frauen im Aufstieg exhibition. Now I noticed that in almost all the pictures you see here, the workers are almost exclusively men. That means that women did not play a role in construction?
Of course they played a role. Yes, there were women, not very many, but there were women. There were women in the canteen, in other words, the canteen manager who was... The canteen was run by a woman, of whom we actually have original audio. Original audio examples up here, where you can hear her talking today about how it was that they practically made the last snack at midnight and then started again at 5 or 6 in the morning with breakfast for the first workers. There were so-called operators, those who cleaned the barracks, the workers' living quarters, who were also women. The most important woman, from Wallach's point of view, was certainly his wife. Josephine, who... She did so much for him, that is, she had his back, she organized so much, she knew everything, and always stayed very much in the background, but he always mentioned her in speeches and thanked her again and again. And yes, she certainly had a large part in the fact that his work went very, very well. Went very, very well, it has to be said.
Andrea, Sibylla, thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you very much.
This was a new episode of Glockner Gipfel, the podcast of Großglockner Hochalpenstraßen AG. This time we visited the exhibition on the construction of the road. We would be delighted if you enjoyed it and would like to leave us a positive review on the podcast platforms or recommend the Glockner Gipfel to others. For more information, please visit our website at großglockner.at or send us an email at info@großglockner.at. Thank you for listening and see you next time at the Glockner Gipfel.
This podcast was recorded in German language and then transformed to English with the help of artificial intelligence.